Stories of innovation and success from the vibrant communities of rural Nova Scotia. This is Ignited.
Welcome to Ignited, the podcast, where we celebrate innovation and rural success. I'm Wade Cleveland. I work for a rural innovation hub called Ignite. We help build vibrant economies in rural Nova Scotia by bringing together startups and industry, youth, and community. This is number 3 of our annual Women Founders Series podcast. Today, I have a really fun conversation with Chef Gabrielle Legourier, a native Nova Scotian who, with her husband, European sommelier Gabor Bodo, have created something truly unique, Gourmet Gab by Pertu. Gourmet Gab brings high-end culinary and wine experiences right to your home. Gabrielle is a Michelin-trained chef who has cooked for many celebrities, world leaders, and most notably, her last job before the creation of Gourmet Gab was sous chef to the royal family and one of the last to work for Her Late Majesty the Queen of England. Chef Gab, you have an amazing story, and I can't wait to get into it. So where do we start?
We will start when I was 15. So that was my epiphany moment. We'll start there. I went to a Sobeys cooking class upstairs at Sobeys. They do these kids and adult cooking classes. And it was my best friend's mother's idea for March break that we would do that. And we kind of rolled our eyes because we were 15. And we went, and I grew up where my dad was the main cook in the household. So he was the chef and foodie of our house. And I didn't really see myself in that position. As much as I liked food and I liked what he did and I was excited by it, I didn't really think of women as chefs, like, because it's both on TV and at home, it was just not the case. And here I am seeing this incredibly cool chef woman that was teaching me, I think it was a Caribbean-inspired cooking class. And I remember specifically when she was opening the avocado with her knife and twisting the avocado and doing all these cool knife skills and tricks. And I just thought, you are the coolest person I've ever seen. That's it. I want to be you. It honestly was as simple as it was like, you're cool. I want to be you. I can see myself in your shoes. And after that, it really did have a big effect. I decided to go to the Culinary Institute of Canada. So that summer, at the age of 15, I toured in PEI, their campus, knowing that it would be a couple years later that I would go, but just to kind of get myself excited and meet everyone there. And I loved the tour, was set on it. I thought to myself, if I don't get into this school, I'm gonna have a meltdown. No, just kidding, not a meltdown, but I was gonna be very disappointed. And lo and behold, a few years later, when I did my application, I got accepted. And I went to the Culinary Institute of Canada for 2 years, and I did my internship in Lake Louise. So I got to go to the Rocky Mountains, actually surrounded by the mountains when you're there, which was so amazing, and worked at my first restaurant in a lodge called Deer Lodge. And I got to learn about game meat and a lot of like West Coast or I guess Western style cuisine. And then I came back for my second year and loved it even more. And I think, dare I say, I was even more focused. Whereas first year, you know, first year, your first year at home. Let's just leave it there. And then after that, I went back to New Brunswick. And long before we had Michelin here in Canada, we had what was called a diamond system. And so there was the maximum of 4 diamonds. So I went to work at a restaurant that had 4 diamonds in Moncton, New Brunswick, called Little Louis Oyster Bar. That was my first ever kind of fine dining experience.
Okay, how old were you then?
Gosh, I guess after graduation, then the internship, I would say I was about 18. I turned 19 while working there, let's say that. Yeah, so first ever, and it was intense, let me tell you that. It was during a time where Gordon Ramsay was in the height of his power. So a lot of chefs were trying to act that way, and, you know, that kind of says something. So it was very intimidating kitchen. But I think that was where I learned yes chef, no chef, and my place in the kitchen, and that I would have to work really hard to get to the place where someone was saying yes chef, no chef to me. But I did decide then and there that I would not be Gordon Ramsay-esque. As cool as he was, I was never going to be that way. As you can tell, very cheerful, very talkative. So, yeah, that's the beginning of my story, really.
That's kind of an amazing story. At a young age, you decided you were going to do this. You're obviously a go-getter and even from a young age seemed to be very focused.
Yeah, I mean, I was very determined. And I think, I don't know where that comes from, but I've always kind of seen a path and looked at how to move forward. And as soon as I fell in love with the world of fine dining and cooking, I thought, okay, next step. So for me, it was very intentional everywhere that I worked. And I wanted to work with the best and learn from the best. And then along that journey, figure out what kind of chef I was going to be eventually. So I worked in all forms of chefing, you know, from hotels to restaurants to private households to catering facilities to chef teaching.
All right. So how did you get to London?
What took me to London? So after Little Louise, I went all the way to the West Coast, again, all the way to the West, I mean to Vancouver. And I worked in a restaurant called Chin Chin off of Robson Street in Vancouver, an Italian-based fine dining restaurant. And a lot of my colleagues had done their two-year youth mobility visa to London. And they were ranting and raving about it. They said, you know, I went there for 2 years. It's really easy as a Canadian to get that visa. Do it before 30. It's amazing. You'll love the city. It's an exciting opportunity. It's really cool to get that on your CV. And I work in some of their incredible restaurants and hotels. Just do it. They were talking about it all the time. So it was around me and it was a good influence. And I thought, you know what? Why not? You know, I wasn't really set in staying in Vancouver, but I liked an adventure. And why not go the opposite direction, relatively the same distance from home? So I did. I went and I applied for the visa, got the visa, went to London, and decided to focus on fine dining cuisine again, but this time Michelin, which didn't exist in Canada at the time. So that was my goal, but it was hard to get to because I didn't have that background at that level back home. So I first worked as an agency worker, which kind of put me all over this big city. It was great to kind of map out the city that way. But eventually it put me at the Kona Hotel, which was a 5-star hotel that had in it a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. And I thought, yes, this is what I came here for. And I fell in love with that hotel, but I was an agency worker, meaning I was working for the agency. I wasn't going to be there permanently unless they got me from the agency. I guess they liked me. And I, being from New Brunswick, I was bilingual, and most of the kitchen was French chefs from France. And so they said, you know, you fit in. We like your attitude. We're going to buy you from the agency. So they bought me from the agency for the Kona Hotel, and I started a week later. And that is also where I met my husband. So it was a win-win-win, ladies and gentlemen. From that 5-star hotel restaurant, because there was 2 in the side of the hotel, I went over and worked at their Michelin restaurant, which was a 2-Michelin-starred restaurant, for my first ever woman chef, which was very exciting.
This is an interesting thing. The profession of chefs is very male-dominated.
Very.
So as a woman, is that an issue? Does it become an issue? And how do you overcome those kind of things?
Oh, goodness. I mean, it's changed so much since when I started. And never mind the generations before me. But so if we go back to when I first ever went to the culinary school to tour it around, the chef that was giving me the tour, she was one of the first head chefs, woman head chefs on the East Coast of Canada. And I think this was back in the 70s, late 70s, 80s. So that tells you something. So I kind of knew that going in. And she was saying, you know, just keep your passion. It's going to be brutal. It's going to be intense. Just keep your passion. Keep that sparkle in your eye. And you'll enjoy it. And you'll do amazingly. So I focused on that. But I, you know, in Michelin, for example, I was one of 2 women. The rest, both in pastry and in savory kitchen, was all men. So we tend to stick together. But you do also have to kind of modify yourself in the way that you have to change a little bit back then, how you spoke, how you acted, to fit in, to be one of the boys, quotation marks. So I remember, that's a good story. Gosh, so many side stories. When I met my husband at that hotel, and I'd been working in the industry, I guess, by then, you know, 5 to 7 years, he's like, you swear a lot. And I was like, I didn't even notice it. It just became habit because everyone just kind of swears in the kitchen, whether it's for that it's intense and it's a way of releasing that tension, or it's just at each other, or, you know, it gets heated, actually heated. And I didn't notice. And he said, you know, it would be kind of nice if you kind of stopped that. He wasn't a big fan of it. And I understand, because it is now that I don't swear as much, and you won't hear me swearing on this podcast, it's deterring in a lot of ways. And I think it often when people swear a lot shows that they have a lot of anger in them. And so I was working with a lot of angry people, I think, and I was trying to fit in that world, even though I'm not really an angry person. And So that just shows an element of how I had to change the way I am. But I also had to laugh off inappropriate jokes. I had to really be extremely resilient. If I burn myself, don't really react to that. Don't really react to the intensity of the shifts we were working. Just make sure that I could handle it. And there were always small comments on, like, are you going to cry? Because you are a girl. Like, are you going to, can you handle it? Because you are a girl. Or, you know, and I remember, it's funny now looking back because of who I am now and how I feel about myself now, but I remember my last day in Michelin, for example, and I'd worked, you know, 18-hour days for the 8 months that I worked there. And sometimes I would show, actually, sometimes it would be even longer. I would show up at 5:30 a.m. I'd go in when my husband was going in for his breakfast shift, and I'd finish at 11:30 p.m. and barely have a break or, you know, a couple of bites to eat in between. And the head chef at the time did a cheers, like he did at the end of anyone's kind of term working there. And he said, to the prettiest and nicest chef that we worked with. That's all he had to say. And I just thought, wow, okay. That's how they surmised my experience.
It's nice to be nice, but how about getting some credit for all the hard work
yes,
you put in?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think all those things, all you can really do is just think about what you will be when you do have that seat at the table and or that opportunity to have more influence. And I just think I just took little notes. Like I didn't actually have a little book that I was writing this down, but clearly mental notes to where I thought, you know, when I get on podcasts like this, when I'm speaking to younger chefs, when I'm speaking to other women chefs that are starting out, these are the stories I'm going to tell them. And I'm going to tell them how it worked for me and that it's going to exist, but it's getting easier.
And when you're in that spot,
yeah,
you can be your own person.
Yeah.
And let that influence kind of
yes,
run through.
Yes, absolutely.
That feels powerful in its own way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think knowing that you will get there, I think that helps propel you.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of, that belief, even if it's a silly belief, like even if it actually isn't fruitful, I think that sort of determination helps get through a lot of things in life. And that's kind of what propelled me from A to B to all of my career choices was just like, I can do this, you know, that belief. And I'll do it my way. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
It really sounds like, though, from what you've described, very much the way I would picture it stereotypically, a lot of anger,
mm-hmm.
a lot of swearing, a lot mm-hmm. of smashing and banging.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Gordon Ramsay way
of
doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what it is. You know, nowadays, because the show The Bear is becoming so popular, you know, I get asked so much about, like, do you watch The Bear? Blah, blah. And what I find fascinating, and I will watch it. I have nothing against it. I'm thinking it's fantastic. There's a show that's about my world or the world that I know. Not specifically my world, but the world that I know. It is fascinating. My own father's like, you got to watch The Bear. It's just so intense. And I'm like, that's what I've been living for like the past 15 odd years. So it is cool. It's awesome that it's being put out there in a more realistic way, because I think from what I've heard too with The Bear, it talks about how wonderful some of the relationships can be in the kitchen. I mean, I met my husband in the hotel that we worked at. That doesn't happen for everybody, but I'm beyond romantic relationships, because you're working long hours, you form these incredible friendships. So I have a lot of people that maybe I don't see them nearly as often as I'd like, but I still maintain, you know, either an online friendship or I see them when I can, when I'm back in London and we wish each other well. And it's like a brotherhood kind of thing. So I kind of feel like I've met a lot of brothers along the way because it was almost like a family. You're in the trenches together, you're working really hard, and you have the opportunity and the time to form really incredible relationships and get to know each other really well. So I'm glad it's showing that, because that's the kind of the flip side to the intense kind of hostility, is there's also some incredible people that have helped me out over the years and vice versa. So it's cool that beyond Hell's Kitchen, we're showing that whole side of, and the intensity too, of being accepted in fine dining, coming from a more casual background or going back to casual after fine dining. It explores all those things that I can relate to.
I have to ask.
Yeah.
How did you end up working for the royal family? How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. When we do our events, we always do a little bit of like kind of a condensed version of how you and I have been speaking right now about like our backgrounds and what brought us here to Nova Scotia. And in order to understand that move, you almost need to have some of the other moves before it, because otherwise people just it doesn't register. It's like how did that jump get there? Or how did you make that jump? So my last job before working for the royal family, I was actually head chef of a vegan restaurant, which is so important for chefs these days to understand plant-based, gluten-free, dairy-free, organic, biodynamic, all of that world, and it was all of those things. So I was working there, and it happened, I didn't plan it this way, but happened to be owned by the Al Fayeds. So most people know Dodi Fayed, the last boyfriend for Diana. So weird connection there. But I worked for Camilla Fayed, who owned a pharmacy with an F. It was a vegan restaurant in Notting Hill. The chef that replaced me there, he was the former chef of the Oriental Express. So really cool
wow.
guy. Yeah, really cool Scottish chef. And him and I really hit it off and became buddies. It wasn't like there was that kind of awkward passing the torch. We just, we got on really well. And he really wanted to support my next step in my journey. And he said, do you have LinkedIn? And I said, no, chefs don't need LinkedIn. Now I think otherwise. But for a long time, we didn't. It was like, no, you just, you know, you applied in different ways. And he showed me his phone, and on there was, senior sous chef to the royal household, because he followed the head chef there, or was friends with, actually. And he said, go for this. Would you go for this? And I said, that's a bit random. Sure. that was kind of my thought. And so I did. And it was a very interesting process to get me in those doors. But I did. I managed to get the position of sous chef. And so there was four sous chefs in total, because there's different households. And so sometimes I was at Buckingham Palace, sometimes other locations. Sometimes I was in charge of 40 chefs. Sometimes I only had one or two. And so it was really an interesting role, because it was constantly changing, and our responsibilities were always changing. So yeah, it was an incredibly exciting journey. Yeah.
It had to be. And truly a feather in your cap. I don't know if it is on a professional level, but somebody tells me that they used to work for the royal family. That gives you pause. That's pretty amazing.
Well, for me, it was always about the culinary challenge. And, you know, I really thought historically, because just the way that food history is and was, it, a lot of times, at least when it comes to how restaurants were born, especially in like France and in England, it was first there were chefs that worked for the royals. And then that style of cuisine, nouveau cuisine, fine dining cuisine, then became accessible when restaurants opened. So the first ever restaurants, quotation marks, the first ever chefs were chefs of royalty, if you think about it, fine dining chefs, that is. So just that in itself, I was like, that's intriguing. I just wonder what traditions have been passed down, like what it still exists there. And there was a lot of traditional dishes that I had only really heard about in chef school and then never saw again, like, you know, a souffle, like a cheese souffle. How many chefs do souffles every day? And like none of us really. But that was every single day when I was there. So there was a lot of interesting cuisine opportunities and things to add to, you know, my journey and my cookbook eventually, you know. It was just an opportunity I couldn't turn down.
How did you get from there to here? What led you both to come here to Canada again and come back and come home?
So around, I would say, 2018, kind of around the time where the effects of Brexit were settling in, we'll say. We thought, you know, we love the UK. We love London. We have friends here. My husband has family there. But I think I just want to go to a quieter, more, I don't know, relaxing place that still feels like home. That's still close to Gab's family in Europe and put roots in the ground. And so we made the decision to move back to Nova Scotia. All my immediate family live here, so it was a no-brainer as to have our support system and kind of set up shop here. So we made that decision, and I decided not to reapply for my visa. I was at that point on a visa because I was married to Gabber, who was an EU citizen. If I wanted to renew that, we would have to do some separate paperwork to remain Basically, that's how it worked in the UK. And we decided not to. We thought this is our journey here finished. And then when we did end up moving, I moved a month before the pandemic, and my husband actually got here a week before borders closed.
Oh, wow.
So it was tight, really tight.
So you show up here, there's a massive shutdown worldwide.
Yeah.
In effect, you're stuck.
Yeah.
You're stuck here. All of a sudden, you're in the middle of nothing.
Yeah.
Because you can't move.
Yeah.
What happened then? That must have been really...
It was an interesting one to explain to my husband in particular, because it was his first time living in Canada, right? For me, it was like, okay, this is just weird times across the board, no matter where you live. But for him in particular, because it was so close to shutdown, it was like... Does Canada suck or is this the pandemic? Like, I can't tell. So it did take him a couple of years to understand, like, what is life here actually like, you know? Like, because it wasn't a good example.
No, nothing
anywhere.
Was the same.
Nothing was the same. And so it took a long time. And in fact, nothing will be the same. There's a lot of things that have changed. A lot of great things have come from it. Like our business, for example, side note. But things are vastly different from even like the Halifax before, the Nova Scotia before, the world before, you know, even visiting London since the London before. So it was a harsh transition for him and even for myself too, because when I first moved here, I thought I would go back to teaching. And so I applied at a lot of the chef schools, including my old chef school. And then none of those opportunities were available anymore. So out of that, we created Gourmet Gap.
I want to tell you about our Igniting Women in Business series at Ignite, providing rural women entrepreneurs an opportunity to connect, learn, and build their network through a series of initiatives, including a speaker series, gala, and retreat. We hope to inspire and empower rural women in business across the province. The theme is relearning through a women's lens. The sessions offer a space for women to discuss challenges that are faced by rural women in entrepreneurship, with opportunities to learn, network, and socialize. For more information on Igniting Women in Business and to sign up for our events newsletter, visit igniteatlantic.com.
So Gourmet Gap really came from COVID.
Yeah, out of necessity. Honestly, it was a very random occurrence, which I don't know if they're, like, I have a lot of friends that are in small businesses. A lot of their businesses started from a lot of planning and forethought. Ours kind of didn't. Ours kind of just happened to us, and then we had to catch up. August 2020 is our...
The height of the lockdown.
The height of the lockdown. Well, we weren't quite, yeah. I mean, we were definitely in COVID times, but it wasn't in lockdown. It was in, you can have 8 people in your home.
Right,
or
I remember
10,
that.
8 to 10, yeah. And one of our family friends said, would you do a dinner party for my girlfriend's 40th? You know, we can't sit more than 4 at a restaurant at this point, and it's a big birthday, and I want to do something special, and we know a chef and sommelier locally, I don't know. And I said, let me look at my really busy schedule, which was like, I don't know, Ozark season 2 starts this day. That's it. That was my schedule. Very embarrassing. And I just wrote down a quick questionnaire, which is still sort of the questionnaire that we send our clients now, which was like, what would you like? What style of cuisine would you like? You know, how many people are there? Are there any dietary requirements? Would you like wine pairings? Da, 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 da. And went through that and created this dining experience, a sit-down dining experience for the guests designed specifically to celebrate our friend's girlfriend and her birthday. And Gab, my husband, who's a sommelier, paired all the wine and shook a couple cocktails to start and kickstart the evening off. And at the end of the evening, they said, come here, you have to sit down with us. And I thought, okay, do we sit down? I don't know. Are we even allowed to sit down? I mean, it was just weird times. So I think we kind of kneeled against the table. And they said, you need to create a business out of this. Like, this needs to be shared with more people. And we were like, huh? And from that event, you know, we felt really excited, but we got a phone call like 2 days later. Do you want to book us, like someone from that dinner party, do you want to book us for next month? Are you available on this date? And I was like, again, let me look at my busy schedule. And I put them in. So we started with one event a month. And then from that, another booking. And from that, another booking. And to the point where it was, you know, we were having 2 to 3 events a month, then we needed business cards, you know, then we needed to start to sort out having dishware and all the other things had to come into place bit by bit as we could. All the while, my husband, who thank goodness he did this, was working at Westside, which is like a beer, wine, spirits shop. So he was learning about what Nova Scotians like to drink, what they like to pair with, you know, the local beer, the local wine. And that kind of propelled us through lockdowns after that so that we could keep coming back to Gourmet Gab. And so we just kept coming back to Gourmet Gab until all the lockdowns were done. And here we are. This past August, we celebrate our fourth year of business.
That is a remarkably organic story. Did you ever go through that phase of, okay, let's make a plan? Did you ever actually create a literal business plan and go through all those processes, or did it just kind of organically grow?
It was almost just the latter. Like, it was just a lot of tweaking, a lot of tweaking. I mean, now it's a lot more solid, like what we sell and what we do and what we don't do and the numbers that we were willing to take on and the style in which we serve our guests and the pricing, all those things had to be tweaked. And it's because we didn't know what we were doing at the beginning. So where we are now, we're really comfortable with, and it seems to be selling really well. Now we're at about 3 to 4 events every single week. And my husband also has a wine club. So between Gourmet Gab and Pertu Wine, we're busy, you know, full time.
So 3 or 4 events every week?
Every week, yeah.
And it feels to me, now, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels to me that that's a word of mouth growth as opposed to—
Huge.
You're not spending a lot of time marketing, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like a huge percentage is word of mouth, and then the other is social media. And, mm-hmm. you know, for a small business now, something like, I would say Instagram the top, but also a bit Facebook. If you just post frequently on that, it's like you're free advertising constantly. So people book us a lot from Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we kind of put energy or time into. But again, we're not even paying for ads. We haven't, other than business cards and the odd pamphlet, paid for anything as far as...
This is the most unusual entrepreneur story, I have to be honest with you, that I've ever seen. Like, what advice do you have? Well, just put it on Facebook. It'll be fine. There was obviously a need.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I think it's a combination of, you know, it was born out of necessity for us. And during times where that was the only kind of, we were all limited to what we could do to socialize, right? And then, you know, we didn't know if that's going to catch on afterwards. Like, is it just because people feel safer in their homes now and then they're going to be running back to restaurants and they're going to completely forget about us? People are still running back to restaurants, but they're still running to us as well, because maybe during that time, I mean, there's a very different feeling when you're locked at home and when you can choose to stay home, of course, we all know that. But they get a bit more comfortable in their space, or maybe they spent a lot of time over the pandemic decorating and making their house the way they like it, so they're wanting to show off their space, and then they get to do nothing in the sense of we just come in and take over, so they can just be a guest. So they're in their most comfortable atmosphere, comfortable space, getting a quality of service that we feel is very luxurious. So we want them to feel like they're somewhere else, but they're at home, which is a great combo.
Now, I'm finding post-pandemic that I'm seeing more and more caterers because of the fact that a lot of them are very specialized. You can go to a restaurant and get your clams and chips anywhere you want to go. But if you want something more special, quote unquote, that's where the caterers fill those spots. And so, you know, you have groups that are doing vegan. You have groups that are doing more specialized things. And I think that that's definitely hitting that niche with you guys.
Yes.
And you have the street cred, if you will, with all of your backgrounds, because you have that sommelier background. You have the Michelin chef background. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, what is so fascinating as well is that, you know, even some clients that have just booked us or just experienced us, they go like, so you have like regular clients, as in like people that are doing this regularly? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, like, how does that work? How does that come about? And I, so one of the biggest things for us, and I think something that certainly sets us apart from a lot out there, is that I never repeat a menu, ever, never. Not even if I'm begged on the floor with a box of Kleenex, I am not going to repeat a menu. And that's because I'm slightly addicted to novelty, but also I'm wanting the guests to constantly get a new experience. So it can be the same group of friends or the same family that yearly or every couple of months or seasonally get an entirely different menu that follows the seasonality, the local ingredients that I use. I usually use at least 70% local, if not more, depending on the season. and can be an entirely different theme. So the same group of, let's say we have this one group that books us like all the time. They're called the camping crew, okay? Because they go camping together. And they're all foodies, and they have had a Hungarian experience. They have had a Brazilian experience. They've had a Peruvian experience. They've had a French bistro experience. They've had, I mean, you name it. They've had an experience with us. So they feel like every time it's an entirely different group of people coming into their homes to do that. And they share it by each person takes their turn hosting. And nobody's doing anything as a host other than opening the door. We just come in, take over, and the rest is history.
All right. The way I usually put it is there's a lot to unpack there.
Mm.
Let's start with how the process works. You mentioned like basically having a questionnaire. What do you like? Those kind of things. How does all this work in terms of once that questionnaire is filled out and you're doing, I don't know, whatever night it might be, Friday night, 7 o'clock, where does this all begin? How many people are going into your a person's home?
So it depends on the group that you're wanting to serve at any one point. So let's talk about the main experience, so the Gourmet Gab Fine Dining experience, which is capped at 14 guests. So you can only invite 14 people because we want it to be, it's super interactive. We're coming to the table, we're talking to you. It's easiest for us to get everyone's attention at 14. It feels more intimate. So with 14 guests, usually Gab will have either someone that helps with cocktails and service or a dishwasher and service. So at least two things off his list and our list. And then I will have one helper in the kitchen. So about four people are coming in. And they're bringing everything, and they're just wanting to know where your garbage can is in your fridge and if there's anything wrong or that we need to know about your oven. And then they just start unpacking, creating, and then they clean everything down and put it all away at the end of the night. So on the night, everything's very self-sufficient. And usually guests arrive. Let's say they arrive at 6. Gabor or his team are shaking cocktails. So you hear the cocktail shaker, and you get your coat off from the host, and then we pass you a cocktail. And then you're, you know, hanging out in the living room for an hour. It's called our Gourmet Gab Cocktail Hour. Then I go and I meet you in your living room, bring you to the dining table that we've already set, that already has menus. The jazz music's on, the candles are lit. You don't have to do anything. You're coming to the table. You're sitting down like you're in a restaurant. Then we start with our introduction. So we do like an intro of our backgrounds, who we are, the name of our team, why it's going to be the way it is tonight, and maybe a little bit about the theme tonight so that people understand what they're looking at on the menu. I describe the food, Gabor describes the wine. I describe the food, Gabor describes the wine. So we clink glasses, obviously, if you're mid-conversation, and you get a full interactive explanation as to exactly why and when and how we did that. And then at the end of the night, like I said, it's all cleaned down, polished, away we go. And you can, you know, we swap your glasses if you're still enjoying wine. And that's it.
Always, when it comes to any kind of catering, it's very labor intensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you guys, because what you are marketing are the two of you as much as anything else. So there's no escaping it. It's not like you can send someone else to do that work.
Yes.
That has to be tough after a while. And I'm not trying to, you know, find negativity.
But
that's a lot of work.
It is. So we've kind of just decided that just like we've capped the amount of guests for any style of cuisine that we do, we kind of cap how many events we do per week. So we could say do 5-6 a week, 6 every single week if we wanted to, but we don't want to because we think it's not sustainable for like both of us feeling rested and having the time to, you know, properly source the ingredients that we want, you know, for myself to have a day or 2 days where I write a menu. All those little things need to be factored in for us to deliver the best experience and also be rested enough to be, you know, charismatic at the table and you know, work to our standards. So it all, like I said, kind of got tweaked over time. So sometimes we're like, can we handle 5? Let's just do 5. And then we'd be like, oh, no, really can't handle 5. And then, you know, dial it back down. So, you know, if we do larger numbers, we may only do 2 events. So we have another experience called the Tapas experience, which can be up to 60 guests. And I designed it for that number because it's food comes out when it's ready. So it's not hard on me and the team that work with me. But at the same time, I'm not going to do 3 or 4 of those in 1 week because I know it's just not sustainable. I'm not going to be able to provide that same level of service. So it really is about, in my view of business, is about looking at what's sustainable because growth is amazing and growth is great and you can go at whatever speed suits you as a business. But I think slow is the best way. And it's also okay to say no to business if it's going to affect the standard of your business.
Right. It's a real opportunity to be creative. Your creativity must be over-brimming because you have all these opportunities to try all these things. That's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I love food. I am, as cheesy as that term is, a foodie through and through. So if I'm not cooking and writing menus, then I'm eating at restaurants and I'm trying new ingredients, or I'm going in, like, I found, for example, last week, a really cute shop off of Spring Garden Road that had, like, all these really interesting imported goods from Mexico and South America. And I was like, okay, getting a bunch of these interesting ingredients just to play with. So it's about kind of keeping your passion alive by kind of switching it up too. And I think that's one of the reasons why I do not repeat menus too, because I don't want to get bored of it. I never want to feel like what I'm doing is just kind of going through the motions.
Oh gosh, this again.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk about intimidation. I want to talk from two different perspectives.
Yes.
Because I, as a person who maybe would like to have this kind of thing, maybe a bit intimidated by having you, A, come into my home, which, you know, sometimes you don't always have the most confidence in the entire world about having strangers in your
fair.
Home.
Yeah.
And also the idea of fine dining feels a little bit heavy for some people.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? And I think that's the fine dining world's fault. That's not your fault. I think something that from time to time we're told, either through email when we're doing the planning, because we can be quite formal in email, or in person on the day, is people will say, doesn't, you know, we're casual. We're really, you know, we're really like, we're country folk, or whatever the terminology they use for themselves. They're like, we're, you know, for us, doesn't need to be like as fancy. And I always go, you know what? I want you to feel luxurious. That is probably my favorite thing about what we do, is making people feel special, like feel excited and pampered for the evening. And sometimes it's as small as someone who normally is the host and running around, make sure everyone has enough to eat and drink and doesn't have to do that for the night. Like, that in itself was really luxurious for them. But also, I think, to me, the height of luxury is understanding, isn't pretentiousness. So if I went to a restaurant and someone were to be like, and this is the foam with this ingredient and that ingredient that nobody knows, like it's a really rare, weird ingredient, which sometimes I can find in both the cocktail world, the wine world, and the food world, and I don't ever have any interest in that because I don't think it's good to make someone feel confused and intimidated ever. And then there's no knowledge given afterwards. So it's one thing to use something that's strange or a terminology that's strange, but you need to explain it. Like, you need to give that person the opportunity to feel like they're worthy of an explanation. And the last thing as well is, you never want someone to feel uncomfortable in their own home. That's the worst thing anyone could do, coming into your home. Even if they were like someone that's just coming to paint your doorstep, you didn't want them to make you feel uncomfortable while they're painting your doorstep. Whatever they're doing in your home or around your home, that's your home. Like, that's your safe space and your place of calm. I don't want you to feel like we're coming in to make you feel any which way other than extra special. Like, if you're feeling even more excited about your home and even more pampered, that's the key. So one thing, you know, I do think is helpful is that we are, I guess, present enough on social media talking and sharing our passion and our approachability so that people can see that, understand that, and feel that, one. And two is, a huge thing is word of mouth. So other people will say, you know, we enjoyed having Gabs in our home. Like, we actually wanted to hang out with them afterwards, or we really enjoyed asking questions or interrupting them and hearing their story. And that's the best. That's the best result, and that's kind of what we aim for, while still maintaining that we are fine dining, because we want people to know that our standards are high and we want them to feel worth it for the luxury that we bring.
Perfect. That's intimidation part one. Mm-hmm. Intimidation part two. Something I run into a lot from the other perspective is entrepreneurs who are afraid to ask for what they're worth when it comes monetarily and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever deal with that? Or it doesn't seem like you do, but is it? I bet you get people who are trying to negotiate with you.
Yeah, from time to time we do. And I think this is my view too. With my limited view of business from just, you know, 4 years of business and the way it started for me, is that there are times where you need to take everything that you're given. You just you need to either lower your standards or just say yes, just be like a yes person that's just yes, 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 because there's financially, there's no option to say no. Mm-hmm. And that I totally respect and totally understand, and we've been there. Like, mm-hmm. it's just like, you got to do it, so you got to do it. And so you need to get to a point, and there's a lot of different ways in which someone gets that point in business, but to where you can have the confidence in saying no. Now, it's amazing to say, you know, you're born with it and you knew that going into having a business. But every business has points where things aren't working or they're struggling. And that's the time where you definitely need to say yes. Like, that's where you may need to compromise a little bit and meet someone halfway. Or I would say that we like to meet people where they're at. Like, we would always be open if someone were to say, this is my, like, especially let's say weddings, because we do usually 4 to 5 weddings a year, tinier weddings. If someone said, this is my budget, like, can you work within, we will meet them that way. Like, you know what, this is what we can give you. Now, on the odd time, it's like, we can't, like, within that, but like that, we won't be able to pay our staff. Like, that's just, sorry. Like, that, for what we do, we can't. But we're willing to go the extra mile to understand someone and where they're coming from. And also, we're willing to back why we charge a certain amount. Because I always, you know, this was a conversation I had with my husband in the early days of dating. And he would say, look, I found a this is when we lived in London. I found a chicken. It was a whole chicken for £5.99. And I was like, that's not a good thing. And he's like, that's a great deal. Like, are you kidding? Like, I'm going to make a soup out of it. And I said, when things are cheap, you have to analyze why they're cheap at all times. And two things straight away come to mind. One is quality and the other is sustainability. And when you're talking about sustainability, I'm not just talking about the environment. I'm talking about how much was that farmer paid? What is that chicken eating? You know, like, honestly, just, and, you know, I also worked for Jamie Oliver for a couple of years. One of the things that he said, and I really believe in, is buy the best that you can afford, or, you know, work with the best that you can afford. So we totally get that and we understand, you know, like, there's certain limitations. But one of the core values of Gourmet Gab is we use the finest ingredients. And that doesn't mean that I'm like only using truffle and caviar on everything. It means I'm buying organic local vegetables. I'm buying local and it's more expensive. I'm buying free range and it's more expensive. And in fact, we take a pay cut for that, even if we're charging, you know, what we believe in. We could go lower and make more money, but it's not what we believe in. So I think part and parcel of sticking with that fine dining, it means quality. And so I hope that when people reach out to us, they know they're going to get quality and that we're not going to give you a boxed wine and we're not going to give you something that's a $5 chicken that who knows how it's that chicken lived its life. I feel bad for that $5 chicken. So I think that I'm always willing to explain to someone, whether it's via email or on the phone, is like that's our belief system too. So we got to back that.
One final thing I just wanted to ask about, and I'm very curious about this, staffing. Mm-hmm. I know because I've worked in tourism for a long time. I know how intense it can be. Mm. I also know how difficult it is to find help sometimes. And I find that lately you run into issues in staffing at various mm-hmm. hotels, various restaurants. Mm-hmm. Are you having those kind of issues?
You know what? This is going to sound silly. A lot of the staffing that we have for our larger events to support us has happened organically as well. Sometimes they've reached out to us because they see what we're doing. They want to learn from us. We don't have, okay, so one thing that I can't relate to, so I can't speak to, so I always like to kind of preface that, is we don't have full-time staff. Like, our staff doesn't work 4 to 5 days a week with us every week. We don't have that. They're contracted, right? They join us when we need them. So they always have a side gig as well. So, like, for example, there's an incredible pastry chef that I work with who's also a good friend. She does our wedding cakes and our birthday cakes, and sometimes will help out with desserts at events. She has an incredible, booming, insanely popular cake-making company. So she's got her own gig, but she complements us, and she has a talent that we really appreciate and ties in with our business. So that's how it works. You know, we have a really passionate cocktail mixologist. He also does cocktail classes and at-home cocktail experiences outside of working with us, and we're happy to promote him and talk about him because we believe in him. So people have something else, and they're bringing something to the table. So I think that mutual respect makes people stay. can't speak for them, but I really do feel like that might be one. The other is because we believe in the education at the table and what we're doing and breaking down that barrier, we also believe it when we're working with our staff. So, you know, if Gab's serving wine, he's not just serving it to the guests and not even bothering to show the bottle to our staff or explain to the staff as well. He gives them the education at every event too. And what the feedback that we've had from them is like, I learned something today as well. Like, yes, I was working for you and I got paid for it, but I also took something that I can take to my next job or at home when I'm buying wine or serving wine or in my case, if it's a method of cooking and they go on to work for someone else, I'm so excited that they've learned something from me. Because ultimately, I think for both of us, teaching and doing what we do are our two loves. So I think when you give someone a reason to stay, that's education or opportunity to grow. Paying well, even if you'd get a pay cut as a business, is important. Gab and I would rather do it ourselves and be exhausted and do less than pay someone poorly. I can't speak to those that have to also pay rent of an establishment, so we don't know what that is, but we do know that I'd rather not have the help and take less business than underpay my staff. I think it's a lot of times payment issue is one of the reasons that we're having a lot of issues in the industry, and I think that needs to change.
No question.
Yeah.
Now, what's the future hold? Is it going to continue to be this? Has it reached a point where you can only do this much steadily? Is there a scaling or is there a moving to a restaurant? Is there any of that in the future?
So, I mean, the most common question we get asked is, other than where do we recommend to eat, is like, are you going to open a restaurant? Because if you go to a restaurant, I'm going to go to the restaurant, you know, which is amazing. We love that enthusiasm. But for me, that's never going to be an option because I tried out so many different ways of being a chef and I love restaurants. I love going to them. I respect everyone who works in a restaurant, but I don't like repetition in a restaurant, even if you change your menu daily or weekly, because that's always comes as a defense sometimes for my fellow chefs. It's still repetition. That day it's repetition, or that week it's repetition. And I like new, creative. So I think with that, it means that that's not an option for us. But what is an option is that we expand more across Canada. So what we're doing right now is we travel frequently across Nova Scotia. April, we're heading to Ontario. So we're doing a couple events in Toronto and Ottawa. And so far in our business, we've been to Montreal, Vancouver, Toronto, all across New Brunswick, and then all across this province with our business. So we want it to be still a base of Nova Scotia, but open to travel to create this experience for people. Because we like travel as much as we like cooking and wine. So that's definitely on the horizon. And for me as well, I have just started working on a cookbook. So we're going to be having something tangible for our guests in the near future, whenever I can make that happen with a few jumping through hoops ahead of that.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's going to be a really fun thing to do.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Maybe we can have a conversation once that that cookbook is ready to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, I would love that.
Sounds good. Yeah. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime. And you know what? Near future, let's chat again.
Sounds good. To find out more about Gourmet Gab by Pertoux, visit their website, www.pertoux.ca. They're on Facebook as Gourmet Gab Events by Pertoux. Check out and follow their Instagram page, too. Search This Is Gourmet Gab. To find out more about rural innovation and what Ignite does, check out IgniteAtlantic.com. You can follow Ignite Atlantic on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and follow me on LinkedIn as well. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you subscribed to Ignited, shared us with your friends, and gave us a good review. And remember, you can find past episodes anytime by looking over our archive, wherever you download your pods. And we'd love to hear from you. Any comments or suggestions about the podcast or who you'd like to hear on it are most welcome. Email me at Wade, W-A-D-E, at IgniteAtlantic.com. I'm Wade Cleveland. Thanks for listening. Talk soon.